Two people met us at the airport terminal, or hut. Their names were Kiri and Moose. And like most Indonesians we met, they were small, willowy slim and healthy-looking, and we had no idea who they were. Kiri was a charming man with a squarish face, a shock of wavy black hair, and a thick black moustache that sat on his lip like a bar of chocolate. He had a voice that was very deep, but also very thin, with no substance behind it at all, so that he spoke in a sort of super-cool croak. Most of the remarks he made consisted of a slow, lazy, streetwise smile and a couple of strangled rattles from the back of his throat. He always seemed to have something other on his mind. If he smiled at you, the smile never finished at you, but somewhere in the middle distance or just to himself. Moose was much more straightforward, though it quickly turned out that Moose was not M-O-O-S-E, but M-U-S, and was short for Hieronymus. I felt a little stupid for having heard it as Moose. It was unlikely that an Indonesian islander would be named after a large Canadian deer. Almost as unlikely, I suppose, as him being called Hieronymus with a silent Hieroni. The person we had been expecting was a Mr. Chondo, who was to be our guide. I was puzzled as to why he alone, among all the Indonesians we had met so far, was called Mr. It lent him an air of mystery and glamour, which he wasn't there to dispel, because he had apparently gone diving. He would, Kiri and Moose explained to us, be along shortly, and they had come along to tell us that. We thanked them, loaded all of our baggage into the back of the pickup truck, and sat on top of it as we bumped away from the arrivals' hut towards the town of Labuan Bajo. We had been told by someone on the plane that there were only 3 trucks on the whole of the island of Flores, and we passed 6 of them on the way in. Virtually everything we were told in Indonesia turned out not to be true, sometimes almost immediately. The only exception to this was when we were told that something would happen immediately, in which case it turned out not to be true over an extended period of time. Because of our experiences of the day before, we made a point of stopping at the Merpati Airlines hut on the way and reconfirming our seats on the return flight. The office was manned by a man with flip-flops and a field radio, with which he made all the flight arrangements. He didn't have a pen, so he simply had to remember them as best he could. He said he wished we had bought single tickets rather than returns, so that we could have bought our return tickets from them. No one, he said, ever bought tickets from them, and they could do with the money. We asked him how many people were on the flight back. He looked at a list and said 8. I noticed, looking over his shoulder, that there was only 1 person on the list, other than the 3 of us, and I asked him how he had arrived at the figure of 8. That was simple, he explained. There were always 8 people on the flight. As it turned out, a few days later, he was exactly right. There may be some elusive principle lying hidden in this fact, which British Airways and TWA and Lufthansa, etc., could profit from enormously, if only they could work out what it was. The road into town was dusty. The air was far hotter and more humid than in Bali, and thick with heady smells from the trees and shrubs. I asked Mark if he recognised the smells of any of the trees, and he said that he didn't. He was a zoologist. He thought that he could detect the smell of sulphur-crested cockatoos in amongst it all, but that was all he would commit himself to. Soon, these minor, evanescent odours were replaced by the magisterial pong of Labuan Bajo's drains. The truck, as we clattered into town, was surrounded by scampering, smiling children, who were delighted to see us, and keen to show off a new thing they'd found to play with, which was a chicken with only 1 leg. The long main street was lined with several more of Flores's 3 trucks, noisy with the sounds of the children and the scratchy gargling of the tape-recorded muezzin blaring from the minaret which was perched precariously on the top of the corrugated iron mosque. The gutters seemed inexplicably to be full of cheerfully bright green slime. A guest house or small hotel in Indonesia is called a losman, and we went to wait in the main one in the town for Mr. Chondo to turn up. We didn't check in, because we were meant to be setting off for Komodo directly that afternoon, and anyway the losman was practically empty, so there didn't seem to be any urgency. We whiled away the time in the covered courtyard which served as the dining room, drinking a few beers and chatting to the odd extra guests who arrived from time to time. By the time we finally twigged, as the afternoon wore on, with no Mr. Chondo, that we were not going to be getting to Komodo that day after all, the losman had filled up nicely, and there was a sudden panic about getting ourselves somewhere to sleep. A small boy came out and said they still had a bedroom if we would like it, and took us up some rickety steps. The corridor we walked along to get to the bedroom turned out itself to be the bedroom. We were misled by the fact that it didn't have any beds in it. But we agreed that it would be fine and returned to the courtyard, to be greeted at last by Mr. Chondo, a small charismatic man who said that everything was organised and that we'd be leaving in a boat at 7 in the morning. "What about the goat?" we asked anxiously. He shrugged. "What goat?" he asked. "Won't we need a goat?" "There are plenty of goats on Komodo," he assured us, "unless we wanted one for the voyage." We said that we didn't feel that we particularly did, and he said that he only mentioned it, as it seemed to be the only thing we weren't intending to take with us. We took this to be a satirical reference to the pile of intrepid baggage with which we were surrounded, and laughed politely. So he wished us good night, and told us to get some good sleep. Sleeping in Labuan Bajo, however, is something of an endurance test. Being woken at dawn by the cockerels is not in itself a problem. The problem arises when the cockerels get confused as to when dawn actually is. They suddenly explode into life, squawking and screaming, at about 1 o'clock in the morning. At about 1:30, they eventually realise their mistake and shut up, just as the major dogfights of the evening are getting underway. These usually start with a few minor bouts between the more enthusiastic youngsters, and then the full chorus of heavyweights weighs in with a fine impression of what it might be like to fall into the pit of hell with the London Symphony Orchestra. It is then quite an education to learn that two cats fighting can make easily as much noise as 40 dogs. It is a pity to have to learn this at 2:15 in the morning, but then the cats have a lot to complain about in Labuan Bajo. They all have their tails docked at birth, which is supposed to bring good luck, though presumably not to the cats. Once the cats have concluded their reflections on this, the cockerels suddenly get the idea that it's dawn again and let rip. It isn't, of course. Dawn is still 2 hours away, and you still have the delivery van horn-blowing competition to get through, to the accompaniment of the major divorce proceedings that have suddenly erupted in the room next door. At last, things calm down, and your eyelids begin to slide thankfully together in the blessed pre-dawn hush. And then, about 5 minutes later, the cockerels finally get it right. An hour or two later, bleary and rattled, we stood on the waterfront, surrounded by our piles of expeditionary baggage, and gazed as intrepidly as we could across 20 miles of the roughest, most turbulent seas in the east, the wild and dangerous meeting point of two immense opposing bodies of water, a roiling turmoil of vortices and riptides. It was like a millpond. Ripples from distant fishing boats spread out across the wide sea towards the shore. The early sun shone across it like a sheet. Lesser frigate birds and white-bellied sea eagles wheeled serenely above us, according to Mark. They looked like black specks to me. We were there, but Mr. Chondo was not. After about an hour, however, Kiri turned up to fulfil his regular role of explaining that Mr. Chondo was not coming, but that he, Kiri, was coming instead, and so was his guitar. And the captain wasn't the actual captain, but was the captain's father. And we were going in a different boat. The good news was that it was definitely Komodo we would be going to, and the trip should only take about 4 hours. The boat was quite a smart 23-foot fishing vessel called the Raoda. And the entire complement, once we were all loaded and underway, consisted of the three of us, Kiri, the captain's father, two small boys aged about 12 who ran the boat, and three chickens. The day was calm and delightful. The two boys scampered about the boat like cats, rapidly unfurling and raising the sails whenever there was a whisper of wind, then lowering them again, starting the engine, and falling asleep whenever the wind died. For once there was nothing we had to do and nothing we could do, so we lounged around on the deck watching the sea go by, watching the crested terns and sea eagles that flew over us, and watching the flying fish that swarmed occasionally round the boat. The three chickens sat in the prow of the boat and watched us. One of the more disturbing aspects of travel in remote areas is the necessity of taking your food with you in non-perishable form. For Westerners, who are used to getting their chickens wrapped in polythene from the supermarket, it is an uncomfortable experience to share a long ride on a small boat with three live chickens who are eyeing you with a deep and dreadful suspicion which you are in no position to allay. Despite the fact that an Indonesian island chicken has probably had a much more natural and pleasant life than one raised on a battery farm in England, people who wouldn't think twice about buying something oven-ready become much more upset about a chicken that they've been on a boat with, so there is probably buried in the Western psyche a deep taboo about eating anything you've been introduced to socially. As it happened, we would not be eating all three of them ourselves. Whichever god it is in the complicated Hindu pantheon who has the lowly task of determining the fate of chickens was obviously in a rumbustious mood that day and was planning a little havoc of his own. And then at last the island of Komodo was ahead of us, creeping slowly towards us from the horizon. The colour of the sea around the boat was changing from the heavy, inky black it had been for the last few hours to a much lighter, translucent blue, but the island itself seemed, perhaps to our impressionable senses, to be a dark and sombre mass looming over the water. As it approached, its gloomy form gradually resolved into great serrated heaps of rocks, and behind them heavy, undulating hills. Closer still, we could begin to make out the details of the vegetation. There were palm trees, but in meagre numbers. They were stuck sporadically across the brows of the hills, as if the island had spines, or as if someone had chucked little darts into the hills. It reminded me of the illustration from Gulliver's Travels, in which Gulliver has been tethered to the ground by the Lilliputians, and has dozens of tiny Lilliputian spears sticking into him. The images that the island presented to the imagination were very hard to avoid. The rocky outcrops took on the shape of massive triangular teeth, and the dark and moody grey-brown hills undulated like the heavy folds of a lizard's skin. I knew that if I were a mariner in unknown waters, the first thing I would write on my charts at this moment would be, "Here be dragons." But the harder I looked at the island as it crept past our starboard bow, and the harder I tried to filter out the promptings of a suggestible imagination, the more the images nevertheless insisted themselves upon me. The ridge of a hill that stretched in a thick folding shape down into the water, heavily wrinkled round its folds, had the contours of a lizard's leg. Not in the actual shape, of course, but in the natural interplay of its contours and in the heavy thickness of its textures. This was the first time that I had such an impression, but several times during the subsequent trips that we made during this year, the same feeling crept up on me. Each new type of terrain we encountered in different parts of the world would seem to have a particular palette of colours, textures, shapes and contours, which made it characteristically itself. And the forms of life that you would find in that terrain would often seem to be drawn from that same distinctive palette. There are obvious mechanisms we know about to account for some of this, of course. For many creatures, camouflage is a survival mechanism, and evolution will select in its favour. But the scale on which these intuited, perhaps half-imagined, correspondences seem to occur is much larger and more general than that. We are currently beginning to arrive at a lot of new ideas about the way that shapes emerge in nature. And it is not impossible to imagine that, as we discover more about fractal geometry, the strange attractors which lie at the heart of newly emerging theories of chaos, and the way in which the mathematics of growth and erosion interact, we may discover that these apparent echoes of shape and texture are not entirely fanciful or coincidental. Maybe. I suggested something along these lines to Mark, and he said I was being absurd. Since he was looking at exactly the same landscape as I was, I have to allow that it might all simply have been my imagination, half-baked as it was in the Indonesian sun.